Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Tom Attlee. He's the author of The Tao of Democracy, Using Co-Intelligence to Create a World That Works for All. And he's also the founder and director of the Co-Intelligence Institute. That's co-intelligence.org. Welcome, Tom.
Hi. Thanks a lot.
So this has been very interesting reading for me because I'm coming out with a book myself called Citizen Cyborg, and talking about some of the drawbacks of contemporary democracy, and you have given a heck of a lot more thought to it than I have. And so first let's start off with, what are some of the problems that you see in the contemporary models of democratic deliberation and democratic decision making?
Well, I see us as facing some extraordinary problems in the 21st century and extraordinary opportunities, and we don't have the collective capacity to sort of encounter those problems, to really look clearly at the full complexity of those problems and all the ins and outs and consequences and potentials, et cetera. Our current decision making, I mean, you just watch this election and look at what's being talked about, you know, the military records from 30 years ago. It's sort of like, hello, aren't we facing some pretty major problems that we should be talking about? And so trying to build the collective capacity to engage with those problems in deep ways rather than simplistic ways. And probably the key piece of it is that our system is built, our majoritarian system is built to be adversarial. It's built to be a battle for that 51%, the magic 51% that puts you in charge. And it doesn't lend itself to looking at problems and coming up with nuanced solutions that could sort of meet everybody's or most everybody's needs. It's designed to create a position and to fight for that position and to not change that position if you can help it, because then you might look flippy-floppy, you know, and it creates sides, it divides up people. It doesn't use the real diversity of knowledge, the diversity of opinion, the diversity of viewpoints that's there. It doesn't use that creatively, and an awful lot of people don't even know what that means when I say that. It's like I say to people, do you know, have you ever heard, they say, what's co-intelligence? I say it's the opposite of co-stupidity. And they usually chuckle when I say that. It's like they've seen co-stupidity. They know what that is, even though they've never heard the term, but they don't know what co-intelligence is because they've never seen it. And it's really sad that most people have not seen conversations where very different people can sit down together and talk, and their differences become light from different viewpoints shining on the problem, and you see it. You see the full complexity and possibilities in a problem more clearly by having all those different viewpoints. And if you can have a conversation like that, the sophistication of the answers that you can come up with, the solutions you can come up with, and the level of buy-in you can get from a wide variety of people is much, much higher. And if we could build those into our system so that what we were doing with our diversity, with all these diverse viewpoints, was really hearing them and finding out what are the gifts and limitations that everybody brings to the table, and then using those diverse gifts to transcend all the diverse limitations and blind spots and making something that is that really could work a lot better than the kinds of solutions we have going now.
I think that's one of the things that's interesting about your perspective, is that you really emphasize the way that deliberative democracy can be more intelligent. A lot of the people who have advocated participatory democracy in the past have been drawn to it because of the co-optation of representative elites in a representative democratic system by power and militarism and the alienation of people from their own decision-making when they turn it over to somebody else.
Yes, well, I agree with them, but I go a step further, because that you could just be affronted by the co-optation and say, this is wrong. You know, these elites shouldn't be running things, or, you know, it doesn't let our voices be heard. And I go along with that, but I go beyond it, because for me, that's a problem, because it results in less adequate solutions. If we were always led by brilliantly wise people who transcend their own self-interest to deliver good quality policy for us, we wouldn't have these discussions. We'd be all real satisfied. But the whole project of democracy and the evolution of democracy is to include more and more perspectives and keep concentrated power under control, not only because it can oppress, but because it silences voices that should be being heard in the dialogue to find out what we should be doing with our future. And that's why I'm particularly objecting to the concentration of power in the hands of economic elites and political elites and media elites, because it makes voices not be well heard, because it creates polarizing energies, because it makes it hard for us to talk together in ways that really make sense.
I'm Dr. J. This is Change Surfer Radio. I'm speaking with Tom Attlee. He's the author of The Tao of Democracy and the director of the Co-Intelligence Institute. Another part that I really like about the emphasis on co-intelligence, or kind of bottom-up creation of citizen wisdom, is that a lot of the discussion, there have been a couple books out very recently about the ways that lots of people putting their heads together can make smarter decisions than individuals can. But the emphasis seems to be entirely on market mechanisms.
That's James Surowiecki's The Wisdom of Crowds.
Exactly. And, right. And very little discussion of, well, what about people actually talking to each other instead of betting on things, or, you know, working within companies or something like that. I mean, people can actually talk to each other and make decisions together.
Well, one of the intriguing developments that's just been happening within the last year, and I've been part of it, is trying to not pick and choose which forms of collective intelligence are most important, but to look at the diversity of collective intelligence. The fact that, you know, that there's this classic thing which James Surowiecki talks about and actually has on his book's website, of the bottle with all the jelly beans in it, and you're supposed to guess how many jelly beans there are in the bottle. And if you have a whole classroom of 30 or 200 or whatever people guessing how many jelly beans there are in the bottle, the chances of any one of them, you know, getting it are small, and there's a big spread in the guesses. But if you average all the guesses, it comes up to something that's like within 3% or something of the number of beans there are in the bottle. And
right,
I look at that and I go, I don't even know how to think about that. But it's part of the solution.
But that's a good example, because the way that example is interpreted is that, oh, look, the stock market's a good way to decide everything.
Yes. What's wrong is saying the stock market is a good way to decide everything, rather than saying this is a dimension of our collective intelligence. It's obvious that good dialogue and deliberation also is a dimension of our collective intelligence. It makes sense that if you design statistics like our statistic in the gross domestic product statistic that decides whether our economy is healthy or not, only includes the amount of money that's spent on things. It doesn't say how much, you know, what it was spent on. You know, if you spend, somebody once said the Exxon Valdez oil spill was the most, was the most successful oil spill in history, because more money was spent on it than any other, you know, oil tanker voyage. There's no other oil tanker voyage that had as much money spent on it. So it was the most successful oil tanker voyage by a measure of the gross domestic product. Meanwhile, you take care of your kids, you mow your lawn. None of that is showing up in the gross domestic product. You volunteer for your community. None of that counts. You know, the trees are pumping out oxygen for us to breathe. None of that counts. The statistic itself is insane. So those kinds of design elements in our system also reduce our collective intelligence. So there's all these different dimensions to collective intelligence, and if we take the stance that what's important is how smart and wise we can be together to address our collective problems and take advantage of our collective opportunities, then all of these are resources. And we just have to get smart about how to use them, how to think about them. And that's just beginning to happen. The people have been in these different fields exploring different dimensions of collective intelligence. I've been focused on the dialogue and deliberation dimension. Other people are focusing on others. And now I'm shifting gears to try to embrace these others. It's like you want to talk some about the computerized, electronic democracy kinds of stuff and networking theory and the global brain that comes from having the internet, et cetera. All these dimensions of it should be part of our thinking, and we should start getting smart about that really quick, because we have some big trouble coming down the road if we don't.
Well, for some of these issues, there's a bit of a disconnect for me, because you have a wonderful number of examples in the book of listening circles, study circles, salons, and then things which have a more formal kind of policy input, a part of policy processes where they're trying to get citizen input or develop the consensus conference mechanisms. But in many cases, they're trying to have an input into very, very big questions, and I think that for a lot of these questions, there's no realism to the idea that people would actually be empowered. You talk about cases where a random group of people are selected to talk about telecommunications policy, and they're educated about it, and they're facilitated. But I can't believe that the FCC would ever turn over any kind of real power to a group of people who just came in off the street.
Well, there's so many dimensions to that. It's like if we were designing governments from scratch, and you said, "Hey, let's create a system whereby millionaire lawyers get together to decide how the country's going to be run, and they can be lobbied by corporate lobbyists who try to influence them to pass laws and give money out that will benefit corporations. What do you think of that as a design model?" It's like, well, there's a lot of limitations to that design model, and that sort of evolved, or we sort of ended up with that. It didn't start out that way, but that's sort of where it ended up. So number one, there's lots of limitations to the models that I'm talking about, but there's lots of limitations to the models that we have now. And if people stop looking at just saying we shouldn't do that because there's limitations to it, but rather look and go, what does this have to teach us so that we can design something that's a lot better than what we have now? And how can we go about transcending those limitations? How can we get something better than anything that's been thought of so far, and start evolving and creating government structures instead of being stuck with what we have and finding fault with anything else that comes along? So for me, the idea of whether or not it's empowered is a secondary question. If you could have a group of people who, a couple of dozen people, some people say it should be 50 people, whatever, it doesn't matter. Get a bunch of people who represent the diversity or reflect the diversity of the community or of the country, and educate them about the issue with a full spectrum of information that is really hard to get from the general media. Give them the full spectrum of information. Give them access to experts from across the political spectrum, the people who are for and against and have wild ideas about this or that. Let them talk to those people and, cross-examine them. Say, hey, you said this and you said this. What's going on? And really get informed on this issue in a really deep way, and then get process support, get facilitation support to talk to each other creatively to come up with something that makes sense to all or most of them, and then share what they came up with the rest of the country or the community. Make sure that the people who are officials have it. Get it being talked about all through whatever these people came up with. Start getting people talking about it. Even if it isn't empowered to actually make laws and make policy, it provides a perspective that doesn't exist in our current dialogue. There's no place that you can legitimately point to and say that view represents we the people, that view represents the general interest. The system is built so it doesn't matter what you say. If you say we need clean air, that's a special interest viewpoint, and you need to compete in the marketplace of ideas with all the people who say clean air is secondary to profits or secondary to this, that, and the other thing. There's no place to turn where you can say that represents the general interest, we the people. And this model of picking a group of people who are not being lobbied and who represent our full diversity and who are given all of this informational and process support so that they can come up with something that does, in fact, legitimately represent the voice of the people. It's like the jury. The model we have now is a jury. We take 12 people and we say, this is our community. The community is going to decide whether this person is innocent or guilty. And there's tremendous faults with that system. But we decided to make that leap and empower that group. And I'm saying we can do that in policymaking, too. There's only one place in the world where it's actually been empowered solidly, and that's going on right now in British Columbia, where they have a it's called a Citizens Assembly. You can go Citizens Assembly plus electoral in your Google, and you'll come upon the website that describes it. But they have picked at random a man and a woman from each of what's equivalent to congressional districts there, and they have this group, I don't know, it's like 120, 150 people, and every other weekend they spend a day deliberating about ways to do elections. And they listen from to experts in the morning, and then they talk amongst themselves in the afternoon. And then 2 weeks later they come out back and do the same thing. And by the end of the year they're supposed to come out with this statement about what should be, how elections should be handled in British Columbia. And the government is already committed to take the results of those, what that group comes up with, that Citizens Assembly comes up with, it's going to take the results of that and put it on the ballot as a ballot initiative for the whole British Columbia electorate to vote on. And if it passes, that's the way the laws are going to, that the elections are going to be held in British Columbia. That's the most empowered version. It's not just advisory. It's advisory to the people. It's not advisory to the government. You know, once they advise the people will make the final decision in an election. And it's very evocative. You know, why wouldn't we handle more issues like that? Look at the way we handle it now. TV ads and this weird kind of sniping between politicians and all this spin stuff. It's like, this is not sensible. This is not the way we're going to make it through the 21st century. But something like what's going on in British Columbia just might be.
I'm speaking with Tom Attlee. He's the author of The Tao of Democracy, Using Co-Intelligence to Create a World that Works for All. This is Dr. Jay Hughes, and you're listening to Change Surfer Radio. Tom, I frequently am an advocate for technology on my show and critical of people's unreasoning hostility towards technology. And so one of the concerns that I have about this model, and it's raised explicitly when you talk about the European example, some of the European examples like the Danish consensus conferences on...
which are specifically focused on technology.
Specifically on technology, and they've addressed things like genetically modified food and so on. And it seems like one of the dangers here is that there might be examples of widespread prejudices. You know, like when you talk about citizens' councils, one of the explicit citizens' councils that existed in the United States was the citizens' councils in the South that were anti-desegregation movement. And, you know, so for instance, if we were to have now citizens' councils on the question of how should we resolve gay marriage issues, the majority of the people who would be randomly selected for those councils would be opposed to gay marriage and would not empower the kind of individual liberty, conflictual, adversarial, very difficult empowerment of individual liberty that I would like to see. And so, you know, isn't that one of the risks here, you know, that you could have a bunch of people who are just rabidly opposed to genetically modified food for their irrational reasons who come out with a statement against genetically modified food?
That hasn't been what has happened. These councils like I'm describing have happened hundreds of times around the world, and the fact is the people on both sides, like I describe a consensus conference that happened in England in some detail, because it's one of the few places that actually describes stuff that happened during the council, during the conference. And when they came out with their findings, the environmentalists weren't happy and the industry wasn't happy. You know, it's like they came out with something that made sense to, from a general population perspective. It was at neither extreme. There have been widespread dialogues and consensus conferences done in Scandinavia on nuclear power that came out in favor of nuclear power. I'm against nuclear power. It's sort of like where do we go with the fact that we're different? You know, you may feel different about certain technology developments than I do. I have really good reasons for it. You have really good reasons for it. What do we do with that? That's what democracy is supposed to handle. And democracy saying the ultimate authority in the society is the community. And I have to admit that I have, this is total value judgment. You could say, no, it shouldn't be. It should be, you know, the king or God or, you know, whoever you pick randomly on the street. I mean, you can do all sorts of ways to decide who should be in charge. And it's based on assumptions which, you know, you can challenge them, but they're just sort of bottom line assumptions. For me, the democratic assumption that the people should be in charge and that the people should be educated so that they know what they're talking about, and the people should be put in circumstances where their prejudices don't govern everything that they're doing. And what happens in these consensus conferences, most of the people who have strong prejudices have not really listened to somebody from the other side. Most of us don't listen to the other side. I don't listen at all. I don't go find people who are supportive of unfettered technological development and read their rationales. I don't have time, and I prefer my own perspective, as you prefer yours. But when you're put in one of these citizen deliberative councils, you have to listen to the other side. And the process is made to make it easy for you to listen to the other side. And research on deliberation shows that people change, and they change towards the middle. So for me, that is, I would rather personally put my trust in the people, even though I know that they may decide to have less limits on technology than I want. I would rather have them have that power to decide, if it's really deliberative and not just off the top of their heads, I would rather give them the power to decide and set it up so that they can collectively learn from their experience. So that if they make decision A and outcome A results from that, they can then reflect on outcome A and go, was this a smart decision? It's like our own lives, you know. You go to get to be 18 or 21 or whatever, and the society says, hey, you're now responsible for your own condition. Go forth into the world, and good luck to you. You know, and we all make mistakes, horrendous mistakes sometimes, and hopefully we learn from those.
Let me just interject here about the notion of convergence to the middle through dialogue, because one of the concerns about electronically mediated conversation, and you alluded to the fact that, you know, that there might be this this additional dimension as we're increasingly interconnected electronically in ways that might empower greater dialogue and deliberative democracy. But many people are concerned that it's actually increasing the polarization, because people are increasingly only reading certain kinds of filtered news and mm-hmm. only having certain kinds of filtered conversations with people with exactly the same views. So do you have a strong opinion about whether we're going to find a model for electronic democracy, whether you see models out there, and which direction it might go?
I don't think that the electronic democracy, the power of the electronic stuff is to help people who think alike connect up with each other and take action, and to have access, everybody can have access to the vast collective knowledge that we are. I mean, Google is just this miracle. You know, 10 years ago, you could barely imagine Google, you know, and now we can access information, unbelievable information. That's a resource, a positive resource. The ability of blogs to relay information really quickly, you know, and the power that can have which has been exhibited several times recently in our political lives. There are unique powers that the web and information technology and what they're calling social software technologies like wikis and things like that they offer tremendous promise in particular zones. I don't so far see that they can replace the kind of dialogue that happens in a 5-day, say, citizen deliberative council. There are ways to modify. None of these citizen deliberative councils, as far as I know, has ever accessed the internet as a source of information, which is insane. You know, that's something that should be added in some way into the design. But there's nothing out there that, like, picks a group of people that embody the diversity of the community. How would you do that electronically? You know, and there's nothing to be able to talk with somebody and sense where their energy is, to feel the particular emotions that they have, etc. There's a fullness to the face-to-face dialogue that I haven't been able to see replicated online. I don't say it can't happen, but I haven't seen it so far. So I feel like there are special gifts. The Citizen Deliberative Council can happen all by itself, and nobody can know that it's happened. They can just advise, you know, some official government agency. But when it comes to getting the word out, the web is unbelievably powerful. And if the media wouldn't cooperate, you can always do it through blogs. So why don't we get a bunch of bloggers who are interested in Citizen Deliberative Councils and spreading the word? So again, it's not a matter of either or this is good or this is bad. It's what are the gifts of each approach, and how can we design it to make the best use of those gifts?
Okay, here's the final question. Your vision of a participatory democracy is, for me, in a long tradition of visions of anarcho-syndicalism and worker factory co-determination and students for a democratic society and their idea of participatory democracy. And a lot of those previous movements, radical democratic movements, found themselves partisan in the sense that they ended up in pitched battles with the military, economic, political elites of their day and the parties and groups who were advocating different kinds of democracy. It seems like your book is at a protean stage of that kind of an argument, and it could easily tip over once people saw the real limitations. You know, you get that Citizens Deliberative Council and it recommends X, but the big pharma comes in and says no, and the big pharma wins, and then people get radicalized. Don't you think that there's a natural process of radicalization in advocacy of radical democracy?
I think there's a very good chance of it, and I believe that the power of nonviolent action is if it's used from the co-intelligence perspective, which Gandhi did. Gandhi was not just trying to get his way, he was trying to have a peer dialogue in search of the truth. And he said, if you won't join me, he said to his opponents, if you won't join me in a peer dialogue in search of what the truth is here, I'll stop your operation so you can't function, and I'll make everything go wrong for you, you know. But my goal isn't to force you to do what I want. My goal is to get you into dialogue and treat so we're all treating each other with respect. And if that kind of nonviolent action happens, I have a feeling it won't have a lot of the adversarial past that the new left had. And I was part of that, and I know I've been there, done that. You know, that's not where I want to go. And I have no idea where this work is going to head. I'm not in charge.
No, you're not, but you've written a great book, The Tao of Democracy, Using Co-Intelligence to Create a World That Works for All. And it is an activist book. It tells people exactly, it has a list of things that they can do in the back, and people that they can connect with, and concrete examples and websites that they can go to. So you've done a wonderful job of pulling it all together. I've been speaking with Tom Attlee. He's the author of The Tao of Democracy and the co-director of the Co-Intelligence, co-intelligence.org Institute. Thanks so much for joining us today, Tom.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the AInfos Radio Project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.